Okay, that's the New York Ska Jazz Ensemble with Boogie Stop Shuffle. It's from their album Step Forward, recorded live in Paris in 2008 and released later that year. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. And from the looks of things, Washington, D.C. is just a hub of activity right now. Much of it surrounding crazy investigations and even crazier outcomes. And we're going to go right back there. The focus that we've had for the last 2 years has been on the Clinton Foundation, the eponymous foundation of Bill, Hillary, and Chelsea Clinton, and some really strange shenanigans associated with the foundation. And as we followed this story, it got to be more and more complicated until this week. It's overlapping now with other craziness, some new craziness going on, so we'll talk about that. An FBI investigation into former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton's mishandling of classified information via a private server installed in her Chappaqua, New York home, and also on other unsecured devices, appears to have established a direct link between her cabinet-level position and hundreds of millions of dollars flowing into and then out of the Clinton Foundation. This money coming from so-called donors seeking political favors and influence. Insiders are saying that the FBI probe has produced the most damaging evidence yet that the Clintons did in fact set up and used this foundation as a pay-to-play slush fund. Wall Street banker turned financial investigator Charles Ortel, whose own independent probe has led him to call the Clinton Foundation and its network of spin-off charitable organizations the largest unprosecuted fraud in U.S. history. He's with us today to add some more information and to bring us up to date on his investigations, as well as this now cross-pollination of federal investigations that is now going on in Washington, D.C., looking at different things, but of course they're related. Charles, great to have you with us once more.
It's my pleasure to be back on, Eutrice. Thanks for having me back.
Hey, well, you know, it's not like you committed a crime and offended the public. What you've been doing has been giving us some really incredible analysis, which I happen to know authorities all over the world now are looking at what you have produced. And you, of course, every time you reveal something new, you post it. It's not like you're hiding anything. And as it turns out, I think it suggests that you had information that they don't have, and they look to the information that you have produced to get further grounding in how they situate these investigations that are going on. But first, let's talk about this cross-pollination that has happened this week, where we have the FBI and we have other investigations that are also going on, and it looks like this has taken on some speed. What do you make of it? What is happening here? How many different kinds of investigations are happening, and how do they cross over each other, and what is likely to be the result?
Well, it's a very interesting process, and I appreciate you giving me the chance to talk to your viewership about, I mean, listenership about it, and to you about it. But as we've discussed in the past, the first time I did this was with General Electric, back in 2006-07 timeframe and forward. And much has happened back then. When you take on a problem where most everyone thought GE back then was a solid citizen, a great company with, you know, a bright future, and it's such a big target, it becomes the early discussions are often, well, what you're saying makes some sense, but, you know, if it were true, so many people would have to be wrong that, you know, I just can't believe that this hasn't been spotted before, so I'm inclined to believe you're missing something, yada, yada, yada. And I had, you know, innumerable conversations about that. I'm pleased to report, Bloomberg, the news service, was the first one to really believe in me and let me go on television on September 16, 2008, the day AIG was seized, and make my case, which shocked a lot of people, including GE. And now they have, I think, their Bloomberg Business Week magazine has GE on the cover 10 years later, almost, saying, you know, it's basically the dream is over. No hope. And that was the original case. In the case of the Clinton Foundation, in financial terms, it's a peanut compared to what GE was at the peak. Let's say their cumulative their annual revenues in a good year, in their best year at the Clinton Foundation, all bits and bobs, might have been $400 million, whereas the annual revenues of GE, when I started on it, were $150 billion. And, you know, I had to look through tens of thousands of pages of financial statements and figure a lot of stuff out. So this is, in some ways, it's simpler mathematically. But then when you think about what the Clintons have managed to pull off, they pulled off the political fraud career that would make Al Capone blush. I mean, what they promised, what they got away with, the number of campaigns they won, the number of crooked fundraising attempts they've managed and blended and hidden, and the number of people who've, you know, been hurt one way or another, physically and not, by the Clintons. And still, this lady, in quotes, got 64 million popular votes in the last election in 2016. So it tells you something about the human psyche that you know, people are, you know, we just don't really want to know ugliness. We want to assume the best about people. And there's a mass of humanity around the world that is quite content to send money to crooked politicians because they know for every 100,000 they send, they might get 10 million back. So it's taken a while. I mean, we look at the stages of grief. We think back to, you know, right after the election in 2016 and, you know, the nonstop media barrage against the Trump team and, you know, the false theories that were sent out there that's, you know, saying, well, maybe he's not going to be inaugurated. Well, maybe right after that he's going to be impeached. I mean, we've had an amazing resistance, a barrage of negative press, and it has taken time I knew it would take time for Donald Trump to get his key people confirmed through the Senate. And therefore, I viewed that as an opportunity to reach out to the various governments through intermediaries who should feel aggrieved by this longstanding pattern and practice of the Clintons of raising money for causes where they have no authority to pursue these programs, and then for filing, you know, even now, false accounts in the public domain. So I was able to reach out, and it took a while. Then all of a sudden, you know, about a month ago, I think it was, Utrecht, on January 4th or 5th, we get public confirmation that indeed the U.S. Attorney in Little Rock is looking at this. Indeed, the FBI has been looking at this. Indeed, the IRS has been looking at this for a long time. And so on the notion of the Clinton Foundation and the kid glove treatment that Hillary Clinton and others got really from 2001 forward, where I think we may have reached in the government authorities is not a question of, you know, is this a fraud? That's not, I don't think, the burning analysis that people are looking at. The real questions that are starting to be raised now, rightfully and at last, are why have so many governments overlooked this? Why have so many people been willing to, you know, give them a pass as the fraud escalated and escalated and escalated? And in recent days, actually, You know, I think more of the public are beginning to appreciate that the central lie of the Clinton, Hillary Clinton second campaign was, you know, how many times, Eutrice, do you remember Hillary Clinton or a Clinton surrogate getting out there on the question of the email investigation and being told, well, actually, it's not an investigation, it's a matter. Actually, you know,
yes,
this is normal.
It's just,
right?
It's a, yes, it's a normal
security review. Go ahead.
No, I said, according to the testimony of James Comey, it was a matter.
Well, it wasn't a matter. It was a full-scale and complete uppercase investigation that only began as late as July 10th, 2015, because the Clintons were able to persuade the authorities not to do their work. I mean, we go back. This is classic Clinton. You see it in all their explanations. I mean, we need to remember that, I believe, when Bill was called out on one of these things, I mean, I think there was something akin to a diary where that, where Bill said he was lying to his diary, something like that from memory. But, you know, and we remember, who is the fellow, the New York Times journalist who said that Bill Clinton's a congenital liar or Hillary's a congenital liar? But anyway, you're supposed to, as a government official, you're supposed to guard what are called presidential records, you know, the records of the senior people, because they are U.S., you know, your listeners' property. You're not supposed to, like, you know, you send memos around and emails around. Those are presidential records. Those have to be carefully guarded. And so what bright set of light bulbs said, you know, well, you know what we're going to do? For Hillary Clinton, you know, we don't care. I mean, however she wants to send her stuff, she could do it her way, you know, her way or the highway. And they put up with that. I mean, how many emails, how many senior government officials, including Barack Obama and others, how many people got emails from Hillary Clinton on her Clinton email account? I mean, I know one of the things I was taught long ago by experts is when you get an email from a suspicious address, better not necessarily open it. Because, you know, if you don't know the sender, you could be exposing yourself potentially to malware. So why would somebody not have noticed that during, not, you know, like, a few days while Hillary was getting settled in her new Foggy Bottom office there at Secretary of State, you know, maybe a few days she's using Gmail, which you really shouldn't do anyway. But how did nobody notice over the course of four long years that 100% of the emails sent to and from Hillary Clinton went via, you know, 99.99% went via these unsecure domains? Why did nobody notice that? That's the bigger question. Why did nobody care, you know, that they basically walked off the property and retained control of these presidential records until some of them may have been turned back on December 5th, 2014. That's a big question for me. Why during those long period of months and days did the State Department operate with no inspector general, empowered inspector general supervising a gigantic agency with offices all over the place and, you know, all kinds of money flying in and out and around to contractors, to, you know, for expensive travel and, you know, security and all sorts of expenses, not to mention government grants. You know, why did nobody care about that? And why did nobody insist that there be an inspector general? And then, you know, you have the period December 5th, 2014. Why did it take from then until the 6th of July, 2015 for the inspector general of the intelligence community, which I believe is a high classification post? Why did it take so long for them to see the obvious, which is a lot of the emails that had been turned over contained classified information? Why did it take that long? And, you know, so then the FBI, and I commend the line people at the FBI Vault file. If your listeners Google into FBI Vault and then Google with that in quotes Hillary R. Clinton, you will get to a 17-part dump with thousands of pages of documents. And dump one is a 47, I just happened to go over this last night, so I know the numbers, 47-page document. The first 35 pages are there. The balance are redacted or missing. But the first 35 pages tells you precisely all about, you know, in headline terms, some stuff redacted, you know, the course of the investigation. Then the second dump is something that takes you through a digest of the supposed interview of Hillary Clinton on July 2nd, 2016. Then you get to, if you punch an affidavit into the FBI vault file, you will get a copy of a search warrant that was sworn out on October 30th, 2016, to look through the contents of the Uma Abedin Anthony Weiner laptop, which it says in this, there's a recitation of the course of these investigations, and I stress, these are not matters. There's a distinction between a matter and an investigation. An investigation, I'm told by FBI people, is very serious. It's a resource. You have boundaries. You have, authorities to look hither and yon. And in this document, the search warrant, it relates that there were, out of the 30,940 emails that were turned over on the 5th of December, 2014, we heard how many, I neither sent nor received classified information at the time it was sent or received. I mean, this is like stilted lawyerly responses of Hillary Clinton and her surrogates. What is the truth? The truth is that there were 2,115 emails that contained classified information. 2,115. And an evaluation they also discussed that it appears, the practice of sending these things was basically performed on a daily basis. So, other humans, if you or I were out there working for the Secretary of State's Department, and, you're the ambassador to the Bahamas, let's say, and I'm the ambassador to, because they love me, I'm the ambassador to Antarctica. And we did this kind of stuff once, we wouldn't get plane fare home. Go direct to the gulag. But Hillary Clinton, the amazing thing for me is that this was well known by July 10th, 2015 to a lot of people involved with the investigation. And yet the Democrat Party elders decided, we're going to run somebody who's under a full-scale federal investigation for this, for mishandling classified information, the penalty for which one count is, I think it was either 10 or 20 years in prison. I forget whether it was. It's certainly 10, and it might have been 20.
It's 10.
10, okay.
10 years.
Okay, that's one count. One count of mishandling. And here's 2,115. You're going to run somebody this badly, with this fact pattern, before you get to think about the Clinton Foundation, which I think, as we said before, is the largest unprosecuted set of frauds, not in American history, in world history. It's mind-numbing to me that it would take, the only way this could have worked is if people in both parties, and obviously high-level people in the administration department, were potentially vulnerable legally if they didn't cooperate with these frauds. That's the only way to explain all this, in my opinion. It didn't happen by accident. It didn't happen off in a corner with nobody else knowing about it. Lots and lots of people inside and outside the U.S. government knew about it, decided to play along for whatever reasons, and figured that, at the end of the day, Hillary would win and all these problems would go away. That's what happened.
Well, let's take a look at this, the FBI, the current FBI investigation, which, in and of itself, it's a puzzle because a previous agency investigation went nowhere. So what happened to the Comey investigation, and now what happens to Comey himself, who had jurisdiction over this and was found to have basically, quote, pardoned, if you will, Hillary Clinton before there was even she was even interviewed. She was even questioned. What happens to all of the bigwigs who supposedly were charged prior to this new investigation to conduct a thorough investigation, not just of these so-called missing emails? At that time, it was more than 30 or 60,000. I forgot which number is correct. But really taking a look at the links, because now that's the issue. The current investigation is said to have made definitive links between the Secretary of State and her position, a cabinet-level position, and rewards for people who generously donated to the so-called charity known as the Clinton Foundation. What happened?
You keep bringing that title up. Somebody ought to write a book about that. But if you go back into the history, and I will, I can't call this person a friend. I've never met him, but I appreciate his work, even though we're, you know, we see life through different political prisms. Joe Connison, in his excellent book, he called it Man of the World. I would call it Racket Man of the World. On page 42, there is a discussion, which is, I would encourage the Little Rock teens to look very closely at this. In the book, Connison claims, on the basis of talking to somebody, that the Clinton Foundation began in 1997 using money that was left over from the second presidential inaugural party fund, basically. And he says it's $1 million in 97. There's no tax return for 97. So that's a big problem. Then he says that, you know, the what happened after Bill pardoned Mark Rich was that, you know, no big donor wanted to give any money because the FBI was pounding down trail of all the donors. Well, when you look into the 990s, the tax forms for 98, 99, and 2000, there actually aren't many donations listed that are small. They're all big, and it's not a large number. It shouldn't have taken much time to go down. You know, the FBI would have immediately had the information, as a guess, that the IRS had concerning the precise identities of each donor. And just through doing that work in 2001, early on, they should have seen that this was a fraud. Now, 2001, it started off with this furor. It took a while probably to get the analysis done. Then, of course, we know what happened on September 11th, 2001. It's clear from the notes that are on the FBI vault file that some of this work was, a lot of the work was being led from the New York field office, which, of course, was affected by the events of September 11th. So you maybe give them a pass on why they didn't get anything, you know, home by the end of 2001, but then something very unusual happened in 2002. The new person who was tasked with prosecuting, leading the prosecution of the Clinton Foundation, obtaining an indictment, was James Comey. The person in justice from early 2000 through 2005, tasked with figuring out whether tax cases, and this would have been a tax fraud in my view, is a tax fraud, could have been prosecuted, was Rod Rosenstein. The person leading the FBI from the 4th of September 2001 to the 4th of September 2013 was Robert Mueller. And so to do this investigation fairly, as I've said in the very beginning, I don't see how you can involve Rosenstein, Mueller, and Comey, you know, in any way, or people who are close to any of those three people in a fair-minded investigation of what I would say would be the entire 2015-2016 primary and then general election cycle. If we want to understand corruption, influence peddling, potential Russian meddling, or whatever, you can't just look at one side of the coin. And you can't look at one side of the coin with a bevy of operatives who have a political axe to grind against the other side of the coin. It won't work, even if you know, you're able to reach some set of conclusions. All time afterwards, people are going to say, you know, this wasn't fair. It's obviously not fair. You have, you know, Clinton partisans and Trump haters on Mueller's team. You have people on Mueller's team who are either friendly with Comey, who I would argue should be in prison, should be fully exposed for what he was doing all the way back. And if he committed crimes, and if, you know, the indictment comes out against him, he committed crimes, jury votes to convict, he should be sent to the harshest penalties that are out there, unless he throws himself soon on the mercy of, you know, the process, comes forward and says, you know, I'm going to tell you what happened because I know. I think this has been going on for a while. I don't think this is as simple as a Republican-Democrat tussle or, you know, even World War. I think this is a contest between a range of people along the political spectrum who all want unregulated globalism. They want to be above national laws. They want to fly around the world doing fancy projects, and, you know, parking their profits offshore. And these people are Republicans, they're Democrats, they're both, they're progressives, they're conservatives, whatever. They just see in the way the game has been played since about 1988, 89, a chance for a modest sum, you know, for some of these billionaires paying a politician $100,000 or $500,000 or whatever the number is, peanuts, if you can make $1 billion or $10 billion off these projects. So, you know, this game has been going on for a long time. And, you know, I think, you know, we go to the Clinton history. Many people may not know this history, that Bill Clinton fired all or had all U.S. attorneys, I think at the time there were 92 or so, resign abruptly in the middle of all their cases, disrupting, you know, investigations everywhere, including one that had been ongoing into Bill Clinton's affairs in Little Rock. You know, so there was a house cleaning under Bill Clinton. He had eight years to insert his people in, figure out who might be loyal, to think ahead. And, you know, those people, you know, they've gone in as into career positions where it's tough to remove them. But they, you know, were able to hide or, you know, their partisan behaviors and just burrow into the Department of Justice, burrow into the IRS, burrow into the Federal Election Commission and elsewhere, into the various staffs. So I think this has been a long-term plan, and the Clintons are masters and mistresses at the term gaslighting, which is to accuse your opponent of the very behavior you're carrying out. So they've been talking about it. It's a vast right-wing conspiracy. Hillary coined that term, popularized it with her sock puppets in the lamestream media, just following to right behind her dutifully. And, you know, in truth, this is a vast globalist conspiracy, a vast conspiracy for unregulated globalism where politicians and their extended families and friends get very rich off of globalism, unregulated globalism. It suits them. It suits foreign governments. It suits academia. It suits a lot of people. It suits corporate media. And it's been going on way too long. And, you know, they've been fighting it tooth and nail. The latest excuses out of the FBI and elsewhere are preposterous, that, you know, they stiff-armed the House Oversight Committees. They have been dragging their feet. They've been dragging their feet on Freedom of Information Act requests. Finally, we get to a place where the public is almost going to know what's happening and what has been happening, and they're using every trick in the book, every artifice in the book, to try to deny us the opportunity to have a robust debate about, you know, what secret, how big a deep state should we have? What is necessary to protect the interests of this country? What rights should the deep state have to look into electronic communications, which were certainly not contemplated by the founders of this country? And, you know, who should have custody and control of those records? Who should make sure that those records don't leak out into the private sector to donors? Who should make sure that we're not being spied upon? And if people have broken the laws here, you know, how do we expose that? How do we hold those people accountable? What penalties are appropriate? You know, we do not go to the election booth to surrender our rights under the Constitution to whoever might have won a given election, be it national, state, local, whatever. That's not the deal. All of these politicians, you know, whatever their political persuasions may be and whatever the voters' persuasions may be, all of these folks work for Americans across the board. They should be guarding the interests of all Americans. They don't get elected to persecute the other side, reward their supporters. They get elected to work on behalf of 100% of all Americans, and particularly in the area of foreign affairs and national defense. There shouldn't be partisanism in foreign affairs and national defense. You know, those roles should be held by people who really understand they've got to protect even their political rivals.
But and, you have a situation developing under Trump where there is just open warfare, including involving Trump against his Department of Justice. You had major questions, I mean, openly raised about the competence of Jeff Sessions to head the department and consequently any investigations growing out of this probe into the Clinton Foundation. So you have a real mess on your hands here, and nobody knows who to trust. Nobody knows which investigation is actually authentic and run by the book, and whether people are committed to basically out the crooks, whether, you know, irrespective of party affiliation and political considerations. We still haven't gone over that hump yet. So how does this move forward in a climate in which there is utter, or at least it appears to be utter, complete chaos?
Well, so this is why I focused on the Clinton Foundation. You know, I went down a path of saying maybe I should go into the corruption side, but that's not really my training or background to understanding how that sort of stuff works. On the other hand, I do get how financial statements work, and I was very pleased when I started on this back in 2015 to see that laws on the books and regulations on the books do exact very harsh penalties against anybody who would engage in charity fraud. And as our long, and I enjoyed conversation on this topic on your great show for to your progressive audience demonstrates, I think, richly, that charity fraud is not an issue that divides the political spectrum. I mean, you know, people on the right and left, we can get together and say, you know what, here's a topic where we agree profoundly. Charity should not be front to enrich donors or enrich the people operating. Charities should not be fronts to make it less expensive to support a political candidate. We agree on that, I think. I mean, I don't know of anybody who's in favor of the charity fraud, except perhaps for the Clintons. And here I'll put Chelsea over there on the side and say, except for Bill and Hillary Clinton. We don't yet really know the potential escape hatch for Chelsea, but certainly Bill and Hillary believe passionately in charity fraud. Why else would they run these charities the way they do? So I think also, Utrecht, the answer, partial answer to your question, it may lead to a change in the way in which administrations get seated. This idea that you could win an election and still in the case, presidential election, still in the case of Donald Trump, not have a full coterie of senior level people inserted into key branches like Secretary of State, you know, the various ambassadors, into key policy positions and other positions in justice. I don't yet know. I don't believe that Donald Trump has a full suite of his appointments into the Justice Department or his appointments into the IRS or other key departments like that. I think that should really change. The people should understand in a presidential election that, you know, you're voting for somebody who is going to have the authority to put his or her people in. You know, and I would have thought that, you know, people on the outside now looking in the executive branch, counting the minutes until they'll have a chance to maybe win in 2020, they should embrace this. You know, that if you win, you get prompt consideration, fair and prompt consideration of your senior team. Maybe it should be incumbent upon presidents to begin getting people like that pre-qualified well before the election contest itself, even if that's a waste of time for the losing side. But, you know, so it's not really fair to say, and I know a lot of media print has been spent on this, that, you know, isn't it odd Trump's own Justice Department is fighting him on this? Remember, Sally Yates, you know, she had to be fired. She was a deputy assistant acting attorney general, basically, and she just flat out, after the inauguration, defied Trump. You know, how many people like Sally Yates are still doing that exact same thing in key portions of the government? How many closet political types are in career positions making Donald Trump's life miserable? You know, and that's not fair. That's not helping anybody.
Well, you know, I have to say my heart isn't actually bleeding over that, although I could appreciate your point, because I think this president has really gone over the edge in terms of flouting himself, flouting the law, and being defiant of the law, and making it a point to indicate that he is above the law. So this is the thing that I'm talking about. Here we have, in the middle of what should be a clear-cut command, go find the crooks, do the investigation, let's get some indictments and bring these people to trial. We have all these unnecessary complications about, you know, the whether you're Republican or Democrat, whether you're pro-Trump or anti-Trump, you're pro-Clinton or anti-Clinton, you have the question, the looming question of what role, if any, did Barack Obama himself play in covering here for Hillary Clinton? So it is a mess. And in this mess, you don't have, you know, clear-cut guidelines as to how this investigation is proceeding and whether the way it is proceeding itself creates the possibility of conflict of interest, Mueller being one, Rod Rosenstein being one, and many other people. You don't have a clear path here. So even if, as it is suspected, you will hear about indictments soon or some kind of legal action against the main targets, it seems to me it comes with the downside that you have built-in arguments for conflict of interest. What do you think about that?
Well, I think, you know, I, as we've talked in prior shows, I struggle to understand why, in the context of the 2008 campaign, where there was so much vitriol, I mean, there were some really mean-spirited things done against Barack Obama by the Clinton camp. Now, I, for the life of me, I've never bought the official story of why Hillary Clinton became the Secretary of State. It just made no sense to me. Maybe I'm too thin-skinned. But, and that's why I'm not in politics, but if the kinds of things that were said, you know, and the kind of dirty tricks that were played on Barack Obama, I'm thinking here of the New Yorker magazine cover, you know, that had Michelle and Barack Obama inside the Oval Office dressed as terrorists, one of them with a, you know, AK machine gun, bullets around. I mean, anybody responsible for that, had I won, you know, would be free to, you know, be in a, go about daily life, but would not be very certain to have nothing to do with the executive branch of the U.S. government. So just one example that happened in July of 2008. So I've never really bought all of that. And I think one of the big unanswered questions in this whole thing is, why did the Barack Obama administration, one set of unanswered questions, why did they allow Hillary Clinton to transact her business and that of her senior staff over these unsecured private servers using, you know, antique, in some cases, unsecure electronic devices for so long? Why did they do that? Why did Barack Obama get his own, you know, highfalutin BlackBerry, which there was some tension about whether that would happen? When Hillary tried to get it, why was she turned down and who made that decision? I mean, it's so the issue of devices and servers is something that was on the mind of somebody in the Barack Obama administration. Why did all this stuff happen for 4 years while Hillary was there? Why did that memorandum of understanding get signed, which is a complete, I mean, it's, there's more fiction in the memorandum of understanding than in that Michael Wolff book. I mean, it's just, there's nothing about that book, I mean, about that article is correct. That memorandum of understanding, it's, you know, all the representations made in it are hogwash. And, you know, why did they sign it? Why did they structure it that way? Why wasn't Bill Clinton a party to it? Why wasn't it legally binding? And most importantly, as the Barack Obama administration found its feet during 2009, why didn't somebody raise holy hell about all this and, you know, either kick Hillary out because the extent of what had happened from 97 through January 20th, 2009, just the public record that's out there is so bad that if you tried to tote up all the crimes, it might take you, you know, a month to write it all down. And then when you compare that to what Corinne Brown did, who's now this week spending her first week in federal prison, you know, it's absurd. Just what was known back then. You know, where are the records in the IRS in that time frame when Mueller also was head of the FBI? Why did nobody care about all this? And then why did they get together as a group to try to, you know, do a fake reorganization of the Clinton Foundation, breaking all the rules again? Why, and let the Clinton Foundation fundraise? I mean, there's so many questions here that suggest that somebody high up into the Obama administration had to know about all this. It had to be find itself and himself or herself in a position where somehow the Clintons have leverage over the Obama administration. And, you know, got us to a place where a large number of people, Lois Lerner certainly had to know about all this. People on her staff had to know about this. Many people in justice had to know about this. Many people in the U.S. attorneys scattered around the country probably knew about all this. Many state government officials had to know about all this. You know, why did this happen in this period, January 20th, 2009, when Barack Obama was president, go on for 8 years? And why, given all this mess and all the many scandals that are well known involving it, why did Barack Obama choose to endorse Hillary Clinton? I mean, I don't get that one at all.
Oh, I get that one. That's Chicago politics. I'm collecting my debt. You know, I'm collecting my debt, and you will publicly endorse me, and you will run around the country with me, sit down while I'm being interviewed as the next president apparent. And she actually had the gall to refer to him in one of those interviews as, he's my buddy. But here's a question. You're puzzled about that. Here's what I'm puzzled about. If the investigator, the chief investigator of this debacle, is himself saddled with contradictions and major questions, as was the investigator before him. I'm talking about Comey. So there was Comey, he was compromised. There's Mueller, he's compromised. Why does an investigation continue under the direction of somebody who may very well be handing over fantastic arguments about conflicts of interest?
It seems to me, and again, I'm not a lawyer, but it seems to me when you attempt to square up the way in which this has been happening, it starts with Sessions recusing himself, and then right away, well, actually, it starts with Rosenstein being inserted as deputy attorney general, and then Sessions recuses himself, and Rosenstein picks his mentor, Mueller, to investigate this whole mess, in an investigation triggered by, James Comey and his firing. I mean, it just reeks from the very beginning. It would seem to me that, you know, what you really want to do here, and we do know how these law school professors and others of the ethicists could go on and on and on about the right way to do things. It would seem to me that this flouts, you know, the statutes, it flouts the regulations, it flouts best practices, it flouts common sense. You know, that you would have.
Just start with common sense. It flouts common sense, yes.
It's just, it's silliness. And it's an argument for a wholesale house cleaning. We go in, we look at the trail that's being followed. We look at, you know, who's slow walking it. And then we have a real investigation. And, you know, for good measure, the real investigation shouldn't just be about 2015, 2016. It should be about the 2014 midterms, the 2011-12 general, and I mean primary in general, and then the 2010 midterms. What was going on here? To what extent were resources of the federal government being used potentially to spy on political opponents, to influence elections, to provide benefits to political donors, to persecute political enemies, to spy on journalists? I mean, this is something that really should be investigated with maximum resources. And it's a topic in which the American public should have, you know, tremendous interest. Why? Because all of this is being, has in the past been principally human directed, surveillance. But we cannot be too far away from a day where artificial intelligence gets really powerful, even more powerful than human intelligence. And do we want to really live in this great country under a system where, you know, all humans are subservient to these machines we don't even understand, who are controlled by who knows what, who can be used corruptly for all the worst things that you could possibly imagine? Is that what we want in this great country? There's a robust debate, again, where I think progressives, conservatives, people who are not all that political, will sit and say, no, let's reason through this together. We really need to do something to make sense here. And what's currently been happening doesn't make any sense.
Well, you look also at the human consequence. I refer to the so-called HIV/AIDS program. We still have no idea whether this program contributed to the deaths, which is, distributing bogus drugs, diluted drugs, out-of-date drugs, because the Clintons selected a criminal pharmaceutical enterprise to produce these bogus drugs and then went on a public relations campaign to say how they're reaching out to people with HIV/AIDS. And of course, typically, the Clintons select to do their dirty business in black countries. We still have no idea, on the other side of things, what was the consequence of that? How many people might have died? They had no real medical infrastructure. They had no capacity to engage in such a program. And it's clear they didn't intend to engage in that program correctly and properly when you have a tractor saleswoman as the director of a medical program of this enormity and importance. So we have still more questions to raise about the impact of these so-called bogus programs that the Clinton Foundation engaged in that had deleterious effect throughout the African world. That has not been raised at all, and I think that's a matter for the International Criminal Court to take a look at. But also, it is part of fraud, because they actively sought out business partners who themselves had rotten histories with the idea of just making it look good that they were teaming up with this great company to launch a global initiative about combating HIV/AIDS. We have no idea how many people, maybe thousands, hundreds of thousands, was it millions of people, who basically died because this was a fraud, a medical fraud of mammoth proportions, where they knew that they were distributing bogus drugs, but the idea was to make it look like they were doing something philanthropic. We still have no idea where the case goes beyond anything, with the direct prosecution now of these crimes under U.S. law. This seems to be a matter that needs to be referred to international arenas of law, because this is, to my mind, and this is what bugs me most about the Clinton Foundation, the HIV/AIDS program being one of them, that they selected black countries to do their rotten deeds and to fatal effect, but we still don't know the enormity or the scope of it.
Well, those are great points. Actually, we do know some interesting things, and this is yet another reason why I don't think Rod Rosenstein should be in his current position as Deputy Attorney General. The investigation into Ron Boxey took too long, in my view, to reach a conclusion on such a pressing matter, as you rightly point out. You know, if a caring set of government officials who suspected that adulterated drugs were being distributed around the world using Clinton Foundation sourced money, using perhaps the president's emergency plan for AIDS relief money, should have jumped on that forthwith. You know, we should, if we think of a vendor is allowing toxic drugs into our ecosystem here in the United States or in the name of the United States around the world, that needs to be stopped promptly. It's not like, well, yeah, we'll get around to it. It needs to be, and it just took way too long. The first notices about the problems in Ranbaxy surfaced in August of 2004, June to August 2004. The ultimate $500 million settlement, penalties and all that, criminal action, came together in May of 2013 after the 2012 re-election, or general election, I should say. And, you know, why did it take so long? And Rod Rosenstein was centrally involved, and that's one thing. The second thing we've learned recently, there's a document that's being translated for me in French. French government knew by 2011 that 90% of the money spent by the Clinton Foundation HIV/AIDS initiative on drugs went for drugs manufactured in India and 10% South Africa, 100% were States of America. And, you know, we don't know precisely yet how much of that was Ranbaxy. Ranbaxy would have been one of the bigger players. There were only two other companies. Chances are a goodly amount came from Ranbaxy. And, you know, why is there no granularity on that? Ordinarily, when a charity involves and charities involved in international operations, they have to submit books and records to the public showing the expenditures of the charity in the local currency, the translation rate into dollars. None of that stuff has ever been done by the Clinton Foundation. And here you had, you know, Rod Rosenstein as a U.S. attorney from Maryland, you know, on this case, signing the agreement ultimately. And, you know, why did he pull, it appears to me he pulled punches there. Why also did it take so long to get to the bottom of that Uranium One trucking thing? We still don't actually know what happened with Uranium One.
Yeah. In fact, that's where I was going to go next, because this is also a letter, a part of the investigation, I think, that ought to be pursued vigorously. To what degree, for example, we know that Bill Clinton okayed military invasion into Haiti specifically to remove a duly elected president, Jean-Bertrand Aristide, and then cart him off as a president in exile in South Africa, with South Africa agreeing to hold on to Jean-Bertrand Aristide. Now, how is that explained as policy? That's one thing. Or Hillary Clinton's initiative to personally order the assassination of Muammar Gaddafi. Who paid for that? What was the quid pro quo? And who was involved in making that decision as U.S. policy? It still has not been examined, because it seems to me that people might have been paying the Clintons and the Clinton Foundation to get these particular kinds of decisions made for their benefit. You know, with Gaddafi, the hunt immediately went for the billions of dollars in gold. We've never gotten an accounting of what happened to the treasury, the gold in the treasury. But we do know, because she laughed at it, we came, we saw, he died. Ha, 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 ha. Yeah. But that means it should mean for every American that we had a rogue government, a renegade government that possibly was even renting out the military to interested parties to accomplish nefarious goals and objectives. We haven't even raised the dust on that.
Those are excellent points. You need to have a 24-hour-a-day show.
Well, even if we did, it would take years to get through some of these basic questions. But we've come to the end of the program today, Charles, and always, always an extraordinary authority that you have in this area, and initiated by yourself And I thank you for the thoroughness of your research and the command of the facts of what has been going on here. And hopefully, with your leadership in this area of investigating on your own, we will get to a point, because I see it happening. Journalists from all over the world are beginning to coalesce and are beginning to say, we need to disassemble all of the elements of the Clintons and their foundation and the way they operated. And we need to have a thorough understanding of what went on here, ostensibly with our permission. Thanks so much for being with us today.
My pleasure, Treat. Thank you.
Thank you. Coming up next, Expanding Mind with Eric Davis. And we'll see each other tomorrow on Free Your Mind Friday. Bye-bye.